The final edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
Hi there, I'm Tony Hendrock, otherwise known as Satirius Hendrock, and this is the final edition Radio Hour, satire with teeth. We have a wide-ranging post-modern show for you this week. But first, a few news items we've decided not to touch with a 10-cubit-long pole. We have not attempted a parody of the movie Noah. Nor have we gone near the fact that Jesus might well have had a wife. Yet. Nor have we satirically suggested that the baffling school-knifing spree in Pittsburgh was probably organized by the NRA. You know, guns don't kill people, knives kill people. A very funny piece we'd done on Vladimir Putin being poised to invade Brighton Beach in Brooklyn because of its majority of Russian-speaking citizens was pipped to the post a couple of nights ago by The Daily Show. So we came up with something far more to the point about Russia's most famous bare-chested, bear-mangling dwarf. We also get a unique take on the Supreme Court's McCutcheon decision removing limits on individual campaign contributions from the most corrupt country in the world. We have some useful tips for hipster parents, unless that's an oxymoron, on their options for preschool. We celebrate Mickey and Andy Rooney one more time. And perhaps for the very first time on any medium, anywhere, at any time in history, we introduce the world to our amazing crime-fighting succubus, Rita Rogers. So fasten your seatbelts in that GM or Toyota vehicle, and away we go.
Your son or daughter may be ready for preschool, but which preschool? If you want your kids to meet other people just like you, how can you be sure your children will be pigeonholed exactly the right way for the rest of their lives? Here are a few options.
Send your kid to Democratic Party daycare. It's open to absolutely everyone, teaches absolutely everything, and meets whenever. Kids learn how to fight the power without fighting the powerful. Democratic daycare. We'll teach your kids to question authority. Then, expel them if they ever try it.
Want to make sure your kid doesn't come home with an annoying new set of opinions? Then ship him to Republican Party preschool. We teach your child discipline.
Kids, we let you eat candy all day.
Moms, Republican preschool kids learn personal responsibility.
Kids, once you're a Republican, nothing's ever your fault.
Does it look like your kid is going to be a selfish bully? Then Libertarian Daycare may be just the ticket for your little preschooler. We pretty much let the kids sort it out for themselves. Plus, there's pot.
At the European Union Daycare, we actually take children of all ages, grades K through 12, who come from 28 different countries and speak 24 different languages, and we just put them all in one room. Something will get worked out.
At Coke Industry Daycare, we will turn your children into a nutritious food source for other children. And isn't that what really matters? Feeding the children?
So pick your favorite. Remember, going to the right preschool is the first step down the long road away from anyone who's different.
He's back, Double Obama, in his greatest adventure yet, Live and Let Spy.
When I was young and my campaign was an open book, I used to say, live and let Fourth Amendment protections remain in place. But since this ever-changing national security state in which I live in makes me give in and cry, live and let spy.
Live and let die.
Watch Double Obama spy on every citizen in the world, then say he encourages a healthy debate, then say the NSA won't store metadata, then say he means they'll still store metadata except in the case of an emergency, but he won't say what an emergency is.
I see that you spy on me again, Mr. Obama.
Thrill to Bond girl and Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, as Double Obama collects data from her cell phone.
My objection to your spying on me seems to have stirred you up.
Not so, Chancellor. I'm Double Obama. I'm shaken, not stirred.
Live and let spy. Coming soon to a computer screen near you. Made possible by the cooperation of all the phone companies.
Republicans everywhere are talking about their new hero. One famous Republican said, people look at him as someone who wrestles bears and drills for oil, while the president wears mom jeans. Fox News said, you've got a big, strong guy, muscular and shirtless on a horse, who wrestles tigers, while the president wears mom jeans. Who's this guy Republicans love who hates mom jeans? He sounds like the new Reagan. He sounds like their dream 2016 candidate. But that won't happen, because Vladimir Putin was born in St. Petersburg. But they can dream, can't they? Senator McCain, what do you like about Vlad Putin?
I'm a military man. I respect manliness, muscle, strength.
Well, is it strength to threaten and invade small, weak countries like Georgia and Ukraine?
Yes, so long as you win. Listen, there's a difference between small and weak. I'm small. I ain't weak. Putin is a shrimp, 5'5", but he straddles the world. He has cojones, and he's not afraid to show them. A real leader.
Would you buy him flowers?
Maybe some Axe shower gel. That's manly stuff.
Paul Ryan, what do you admire about Vladimir Putin?
He's a deeply Christian man who truly hates socialism. He's decisive, and it has to be said, he's white.
Why is that important?
Because Russians are not all white. Back in the Cold War, they were swarthy hairy, like tall Mexicans. Superpowers should have white leaders.
Would you buy him flowers?
No, I'd present him with a lovely picture of the Virgin, because she didn't use birth control. She respected marriage as between a man and a woman. And even though her husband was not the father of her child, she refused to get an abortion. Vladimir Putin would get that.
Sarah Palin, what do you like about Putin?
That he doesn't wear mom jeans.
If I told you Putin had warships anchored off Brighton Beach in New York, and his excuse is that Brooklyn is full of Russian-speaking citizens, what would you say?
I'd say better to be occupied by a strong leader than not defended by a weak, stringy drink of water.
Would you buy him flowers?
Yes, I would, because I'd like to see him eat them raw.
So there we have it. Republicans admire a man who rules with an iron fist, who strips down to his unquestionably white skin and wrestles endangered species into submission. A man who creates a society where women know their place, where dissent is treason, where Christianity is the official religion, where gays are perverts who deserve every beating they get, and no one wears mom jeans. In other words, the United States they dream of. The United States saved by republicanism. Or if you like, the USSR.
Weekends at 7 on MSNBC. Tune in for Trying to Sound Like Rachel Maddow with your host, Daryl, Trying to Sound Like Rachel Maddow.
Who is government? What is government? When is government? Where is government? Why is government? How many is government?
He even dresses like her. This is a grown man we're talking about.
Let's say you were stranded on a desert island with Gilligan, the skipper, Marianne, and the Koch brothers.
He's creepy. And he's just what the program executives have been looking for.
I am the walrus. Cuckoo-ca-choo. Seriously.
Daryl Trying to Sound Like Rachel Maddow. It can only happen repeatedly on MSNBC.
It's time for the final edition Radio Hour's finance feature, Money or Die. Last week, the Supreme Court struck down limits on individual contributions to political campaigns, opening the floodgates to rich donors. Here to discuss this is our guest, Prime Minister Bakhshish of the Central Asian Republic of Bribiria, named by the International Monetary Fund as the most corrupt country in the world. Prime Minister Bakhshish, Bribiria has been rated number one on the planet for kicking back, paying off, greasing the skids.
Yes. But we are always studying America's fantastic system of bribery so we can make ours better.
But aren't you already number one in the world?
Oh, only among the 187 nations that admit to pervasive bribery. America does not, but your system of bribery is so much more advanced than ours in its incredible sophistication and sophistry.
Are you suggesting that the United States is riddled with corruption and also lies about it?
Who needs lies? It's legal. I was just in Washington, D.C., where I met many people we in Briberia call bagmen. Here, they're called lobbyists. It's breathtaking. In Briberia, a bagman skulks around and eats in greasy spoons and leaves the bribe in a filthy railroad men's room. Here, a lobbyist walks into a senator's office, openly pays him a huge bribe to vote no on a bill that will save thousands of lives. And they call the bribe a campaign contribution. Mwah! I kiss this to a connoisseur of bribery. This is a beautiful thing.
Speaking of campaign contributions, I understand you've also been studying our Supreme Court.
Yes, this Chief of Justice, Mr. Roberts. Amazing! I worship this man. He has testicles the size of Jupiter.
Well, actually, Chief Justice Roberts is a rather quiet, retiring man.
It's the quiet ones you have to watch, no? Ha ha! This man is a quiet genius! He says when a billionaire gives money to a politician, he's exercising his right to free speech. Brilliant! Because Mr. Justice knows that the billionaire is really buying the politician's free speech, which isn't free. It cost him $1 million.
Well, surely the politician always has the option of voting according to his conscience.
Not if he wants to stay elected, because the billionaire also says, if you vote nay, the way I say, there's more where that came from. Huh? That flashing red sign of a bribe the world over. The gift that keeps on giving. Quid pro quo. As the English say, I give you $1 million, you give me a truckload of quo.
Well, Justice Roberts might call that corruption.
Oh, he is brillianter than that. Mr. Stern, right-thinking justice, says if the billionaire gives the politician an envelope with $1,000 to vote for a law that makes him money, that's a bribe. Boom, jail. But if it's a bank wire of $1 million and the politician doesn't need to be told how to vote, boom, free speech. The bribe has magically transformed into a fundamental human right. Oh, Americans are so good at this. It's a boggling of the mind how you give the digit to useless, outdated, traditional ethics. We Briberians have so much to learn.
Hey, America can still teach the world a thing or two.
And this Mr. Justice was approved by senators backed by billionaires who told them to approve him. He was approved through bribery. Now he approves more bribery. Ah! He's the law! It's not a crime! It's so unapologetic, it's thrilling. If a Briberian judge called a bribe a fundamental human right, the people would drag him naked by his testicles to the Black Sea and hang him from the cliff of flying hags for the seagulls to peck to death.
Unless he paid a bribe.
Even in Briberia, there'd be no bribe big enough to save him. Unfortunately, we are just not that depraved. Ah, oh, to be American. To have no shame. Ever! America is sublime. Even when it commits what the rest of the world considers massive crimes, it can do no wrong!
Well, Prime Minister Bakshish, thank you. As an American, it makes me proud to hear a foreigner for once admiring something we do.
And do so well! Be proud, America! Where you lead, we will always follow!
Honey, what time is my doctor's appointment?
I put a note on your computer, sweetie. Didn't you see it?
Oh, man. Look at all these pieces of paper. What a mess. There's gotta be a better way to leave important notes.
I knew you'd say that, sweetie. That's why I went out and got us Toast-It notes.
Toast-It notes?
That's right. sticky notes made out of toast. Now we don't have to worry about unnecessary note buildup anymore. Just read it and eat it.
Do you like the convenience of adhesive stationery but don't like the inconvenience of dealing with the mess afterwards? Well, now there's Toast-It Notes, the world's first edible Post-It note. Made from enriched whole wheat flour, recycled cardboard, and rabbit glue, and just a hint of walnuts, Toast-It Notes stick just about anywhere. On important documents, computers, walls, and toast. Just write your message in digestible ink using our patented Toast-It Stylus.
Digestible ink and patented stylus sold separately.
Drop it in the toaster.
Toaster not included. Do not immerse in water.
And before you know it, your note is ready.
Says here Dr. Morse called.
Ready for reading.
My lab results must be in.
And eating.
Made in a facility that also processes nuts.
Love the taste of Toast-It Notes. My face is swelly. Can't breathe.
Honey, Dr. Morse just called. He says you're deathly allergic to nuts.
My God, I'm dying. How ironic. Honey, I've been living a lie. I'm gay.
New Toast-It Notes. They're notes made out of toast.
Caution, do not toss at bears from moving cars.
Wow, this must be the future. Where am I?
You are on Earth near Los Feliz. I can see by your clothing that you have come from the year 1987.
Actually, I came from the year 2014.
Really? Wow.
So what year is it now?
It is 2112. Please don't say it.
Like that album by Rush?
Yes, damn it, like that album by Rush. Your name is Steve, correct?
Yes. How did you know?
I took a guess. As a species, our guessing has really improved.
Wow.
That's nothing. I also know how much money you earned last year.
How much?
Almost nothing.
Right again. Is this really Los Feliz? It's a verdant pedestrian paradise. Has Los Angeles changed that much?
Oh, yes, quite a bit.
Do you still have television?
Oh, yes. Don't ask what they charge for cable now.
So the shows still use comedy writers?
Yeah.
Do you know anybody I could send writing samples to?
It's pretty slow right now.
Dumb luck, now that all the writers who are in my way are dead.
Well, you know, try to get a job on the internet.
Do you know of anything?
No, I don't.
My God, how did I even get here? Let's see. I woke up this morning, went to work, came home, had dinner, checked my email, got in the time machine and set it for 2112. That's right.
Okay, so we're up to speed. How do you like the future so far?
Well, it's certainly a beautiful day. What are all those people doing in the park?
They have gathered for a big celebration.
What are they celebrating?
It's Tuesday again.
They seem pretty excited about it.
Yes, it doesn't take much. You see, Steve, unlike your primitive society, our civilization has eliminated crime, hatred, and war. Here, there is only love.
What about global warming?
No, everybody finally got together on that and stopped it cold.
So there's no crime or war, and everyone just gets along with each other?
Yes.
How did you do that?
You wouldn't understand. It's very complicated.
What'd you do? Kill all the bad people?
Okay, I guess it's not that complicated. Actually, yes, that's just what we did.
You killed all the bad people?
Well, I didn't.
That's very disturbing.
What are you, in love with the bad people? Why don't you marry them?
I think I'm gonna go now. I mean, your civilization commits mass murder and nobody wants to read my screenplay.
Oh, don't go yet, Steve. You'll miss the beheadings.
Beheadings?
I told you, it's Tuesday.
Maybe I should stay here and try to explain to these people that...
Hey, everybody! You missed one! He's right over here! And he's unemployed!
Straight out!
Yeah, I'm gonna go.
And we're back. My next guest is new to the Afterlife Tonight Show. Please welcome the recently deceased Mickey Rooney.
Why is it that the Republicans have gerrymandered the Elysian Fields?
Wait a minute. I said Mickey Rooney, not Andy Rooney.
Can't put anything over on you, oh hip one.
You know, I kid Ed, but Ed's a douchebag.
You hit the proverbial nail on my big fat head, sir.
Hi, Johnny. You know what people back on Earth think of us? They call us ghosts, wisps, memories, ephemera. Well, we can show them. Let's put on a show, all of us, everyone from Thomas Jefferson to Wheezy Jefferson.
Easy there, Mickey. You're in the afterlife, not a 1930s MGM musical.
I was told I could do anything I want to up here.
I did not know that. Who told you that? St. Peter? God?
An even higher authority. My agent.
There are no agents here. Why do you think they call it heaven?
The agents are in hell, sir.
Thank you, you state the obvious dipshit. My next guest is very familiar to my first one. Please welcome, from Over the Rainbow, the mother of Liza Minnelli, and the patron saint of gay burlesque, Judy Garland.
Johnny, darling, it's simply marvelous to see you again. Who's the little twerp?
Judy, it's me, Mickey. We can relive all those golden years of Hollywood together.
Golden years? The only golden thing about them were the showers that L.B. Mayer sprayed over my career.
Come on, Judy. Let's you and me put on a show. We can get everyone. Ray Bolger, Frank Sinatra, Alfalfa. Why, it sure will be swell.
Sorry, Mickey. The only Rooney I want to work with is Andy.
Why did you sing Clang, Clang, Clang Went the Trolley? Trolleys go ding, not clang.
That is some wild, funny stuff.
Stuff that's wild and funny, sir.
I kid, Ed, but Ed's a giant pain in my puckered bunghole. Next time, my guest will be the recently deceased United States Democracy.
Hi, I'm a normal 21st century American male. I'm a member of the coveted 18 to 49 male market. Right now I'm in the sweet spot, 27. For the past 9 years or so, I've been happily parked in permanent adolescence, glued to screens varying in size from a few square inches to several square yards, catching permanent adolescents just like me, cavored in familiar locations like beaches or offices or cars or campuses, performing the same actions as I do or teaching me ones I'm happy to ape and using the same words and phrases as I do or using ones I'm happy to parrot, reassuring me that I'm a normal 21st century male enjoying the best years of his life. As the birthdays come and go, I continue to respond each day to the same limited stimuli I've learned to enjoy since my late teens. Sports, cheap beer, life-threatening food, speeding cars, violent mayhem, extreme versions of the female anatomy, and endless trivial variants of the very screen-based technology on which I am receiving all these stimuli. At work, my permanent adolescence makes me swing wildly between testosterone-driven impulsiveness and chronically uninformed indecision. I fall ever further behind my female coworkers in originality, productivity, and creativity. Luckily for me, the system is male-skewed enough that this will not make me financially inferior. If I ever wonder, in the downtime between screens, whether the best years of my life have actually been stolen, that my true maleness, boundless energy, raw curiosity, rebellion, inventiveness, the need to question, are being relentlessly abraded into intellectual incoherence and social impotence, I hurry by such scary thoughts as if they were a graveyard, back to the familiar images of a non-existent existence where irresponsibility equals companionship, dangerous behavior has no consequences, and pain, provided it isn't my own, is hilarious. In America, what could be wrong with being forever young? As the years pile up, I remain in this state of suspended development, hypnotized by the familiar flashing pixels of cars, sports, beer, industrial nutrients, violent mayhem, and extreme versions of the female anatomy, until suddenly I turn 49. Just as suddenly, I realize I've somehow acquired two teenage kids, one of whom is about to become a member of the coveted 18 to 49 male market, and wears his baseball cap backwards, just like me. And both of whom consider me a loser and a zero. I suspect, with resentment rather than horror, that they might be right. that I have no real future. I'm far less fun and interesting than I imagined and was told I was by every available medium. That I am not powerfully built or burly, but morbidly obese. A political, intellectual, and social cretin without a coherent opinion in my screen-addled cortex. On the verge of divorce as the unemployed and unemployable husband of a working wife. My only remaining sexual release, self-induced orgasms brought on by lurid pixels of sex trafficking victims my daughter's age, being raped by permanent adolescents, just like me. Plus, though I don't know it, I have in a mere 24 hours, my 49th birthday, become uncoveted by corporate America, peremptorily ejected from the vast warren of advertising and marketing in which I have spent not just the best years of my life, but my life. So what do I do? I turn to Jesus.
Now, we at the Final Edition are never ones to let a good thing go. We prefer not to beat a dead horse, but to gently nag a dead horse over and over again. And to that end, we want to continue our series of discussions about comedy, about the history of satire and its place in this country and even the world. It's especially noteworthy this week with news of David Letterman and Stephen Colbert and Jeff Chrysler, all the great comedians of our delusional times. But there is one great satirist for real, whose name is close to Jeff Chrysler's often, and that is, of course, my partner, Tony Hendra. If you recall, last week we discussed how he had the fortune, and, you know, probably deservedly so, but it was still fortuitous that within weeks of arriving in America, he and his comedy partner ended up opening for Lenny Bruce the weekend that Bruce was arrested and had his famous trial. So, I want to continue that story, which has some amazing twists, tonight, here on the Final Edition Radio Hour. So, Tony, please, take it away.
So, it's early April 1964, 50 years ago, and Lenny Bruce has just been arrested at the Café Agogo where my partner Nicola and I are opening for him. And off we go down to the 6th Precinct where he was being charged to demonstrate with all the other hip reefer smoker Lenny fans and almost got arrested ourselves. But this was a big story, and of course the papers were careful to make mention of the British comedy team, Hendra and Ullett, who were opening for, quote, Dirty Mouth Lenny, unquote, as he was known in all the papers, and therefore guilty by association. And I didn't really understand the harshness of this feeling against Lenny, you know, and I remember defending him to our manager, Bob Chartoff's secretary, who was this young Jewish woman called Mary, and her response was, Lenny Bruce gives Jews a bad name. And my response to that was, Lenny's Jewish? To me, Lenny Bruce had a kind of Scottish ring to it, you know? Besides, I thought schmuck and shtup were all American words. Hell, I thought Bob Dylan was Welsh, you know, like Lenny, another Celt. Anyway, this guilt by association was disastrous. Overnight, all the work we'd got by being a smash at the bitter end hoopinanny evaporated. Nobody wanted a dirty-mouthed British comedy team. We had to find a gig quickly to put us back on our path to becoming, as Bob had promised, the Beatles of comedy. And it had to be out of town. Way out of town. Luckily, our agency, William Morris, had just had a cancellation in a big nightclub in Texas, and Bob snapped it up. We were to leave the next day. So where is it exactly, we said. Now, remember, this is like 4.5 months after the Kennedy assassination. And Bob said, well, it's called the King's Club, the King's Club, and it's in the Adolphus Hotel, which is in Dallas. And we just had a fit. I mean, the assassination, civil rights, people getting killed, and we were terrified. And Bob said, don't worry, you're not black, you're not Jewish, you'll be fine. So anyway, here's the story of our gig in Dallas, as I told it a few years ago at the Moth. So we're driving into Dallas from Love Field Airport, an airport named Love, only in Dallas. And our cab driver is this kind of cowpoke type who has a very small head and a very small Stetson, which is actually too small for his very small head. And according to his license, this character is named Earl. Just Earl. No last name. And we will discover that there are many people in Dallas called Earl. and many of those who are not called Earl are called Duke. And there are also a lot of Leroys, which we immediately figure out is actually French for the king. There seems to be this kind of suppressed yearning in Dallas for royalty. Anyway, just to sort of make conversation, I ask Earl, how do people here feel now, about the assassination? And Earl says,
well, we're all real sorry it had to happen here. But we're happy as hell that some bitch is dead.
Yikes. This, to put it mildly, is a new sentiment to us. But Earl is not finished. He says,
you boys are from England, right?
Yes, possibly. And he leans over the car seat and he says,
what y'all do over there about your nigger problem?
Holy Christ. I mean, who knows what's going to happen if we answer this question incorrectly. So I keep it light. I say, we shoot them, chop them up, grill them and eat them. And Earl has no reaction to this. He just nods thoughtfully like, that's one solution. Now, in this, in Dallas, city of fear, there is a place called the Adolphus Hotel. And if you're thinking to yourself that Adolphus sounds like a fancy way of spelling Adolf, you're quite right. And in the Adolf Hotel, in the basement, is a very exclusive private club, the most exclusive one in Dallas, which, appropriately enough for all the earls and dukes, is called the King's Club. And it is in this place that we are going to perform. We are very late, so we change quickly in the hotel and hurry down to the basement to the King's Club, where we meet Charlie, the owner. And Charlie is a man of few words. He says that we're expected to do about 40 minutes, and we're on in 5. Now, we're beginning to get not a little nervous, okay? After all, there's Earl, there's JFK, the background of that. We're in a hotel named after Hitler. And worst of all, we have about 15 minutes of material. 20 with laughs. So we're going to have to stretch. And as you probably understand, comedy material that is stretched is not necessarily any funnier. So we decide to fill in with Beatles songs. And now it's showtime. Charlie shows us the stage, which is actually kind of cute. It has a theatrical theme. There's a little apron stage and little footlights and a little proscenium arch and a little drop curtain, which is closed, from beyond which we can hear sounds of happy laughter. And so we part the curtains and look out, and this is what we see. The place is packed. There are maybe 300 or 400 people in the club. And on almost every table, there are a couple of very tacky-looking brown paper bags. And on every table, there are 3 or 4 extremely large handguns. We rip the curtain shut. We turn to Charlie. What's with the tables?
He says, well, Dallas is a dry town. If you bring liquor into the club, it's got to be in a brown paper bag.
We say, No. The guns. What about the guns? He said, the guns. Well, the liquor's got to be concealed, but if you have a firearm, it has to be displayed. Christ. Do they ever fire them? Oh, sure. Yeah, said a couple months back, there was a Jew fella here, told a joke about the Ku Klux Klan. And he points out these bullet holes in the proscenium arch. Now, what are we going to do? Do we quit? Do we go back to Love Field in New York? We'll never get another job. We'll be deported. On the other hand, we can go on and, in every sense, die. This decision is taken out of our hands because the band is now playing us on. It's Happy Days Are Here Again, which is exactly how we feel. And there we are. The eyes of Texas are upon us. And we're going to do our twittering British satire to a heavily armed audience. Now, we have picked our best piece, our absolutely surefire piece, which involves the Queen. We figure that maybe this will appeal to that suppressed hankering for royalty. And the nature of the piece is it's very sort of British dry, deadpan kind of piece in which two BBC announcers are commenting on a royal pageant in the River Thames, which is centered around the Queen's royal barge. And rather than going into the piece, I will just give you the key line, which goes like this. And now, as Her Majesty and Queen Philip sail majestically down the River Thames, the royal barge appears to be very slowly sinking. Now, this in London, this piece kills. It's enormous. In New York, even, it's guaranteed boffo. Right? In Dallas, it's the silence of the grave. It's a cemetery out there. The audience is an oil painting, a meadow at dusk. We are a two-man Hiroshima. And suddenly, from out of the deafening silence, comes a voice.
Hey, Earl. We got us a couple of queers up here.
Another voice.
Sure do, Duke. Reckon they sit down to pee?
Earl, they're peeing right now. Big laugh. Enormous laugh. The only laugh so far in the show. And it's from an audience member. Now, at this point, I am frozen with fear. Totally. But my partner, God bless him, has an amazing amount of presence of mind, and he picks up his guitar, and he says, in his best English accent, "You know, the funny thing is, we are queer. So why don't we stop pretending we're not and tell you some queer jokes? And after that, we'll sing you some queer songs." Wild applause. This is what they've come to hear. Queer Brits telling queer jokes. So we immediately improvise a show which is queer joke, queer song, queer joke, queer song. I won't go into exactly what the queer jokes are, simply to say that they were absolutely the worst kind of lowest music hall queer jokes. And we tell the first one of these, and the place goes nuts. Tony Lama boots are being stomped on the floor. Bourbon bottles are being pounded on the tables. We're an absolute smash hit. And then Nick continues on this streak of genius. He goes into the most famous song in the world at that moment, which is the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand. Except he substitutes the word gland for hand. So here we are singing, I want to hold your gland. I want to hold your gland. And the place goes nuts. Absolutely nuts. They're ripping up the carpets. They just love it. They want encore after encore. And before long, we have all of the oil royalty of Dallas singing along, I want to hold your gland. Yee-hoo! You know. And it turns out, as the show went on, that actually a lot of early Beatles songs, if they're sung suggestively enough by two men, could be described as queer. I want to be your man. This boy wants you back again. And of course, the ever popular, you've really got a hold on me. That one really went down very, very well. Anyway, we came off about an hour later. We were an enormous hit. And it was certainly the lowest point of my brief comedy career and easily the most successful. Charlie held us over for an extra 2 weeks. And for the next month, we were the toast of Dallas. And so you could say that for one brief shining moment, almost 45 years ago in the dear old South, we were the Beatles of comedy. Thank you.
Canada, eh? 2 weeks behind the rest of the world. What's that all about? Joining me are Canadians Neil Young, Emily Letella, Tommy Chong, and Keith Sutherland's grandfather. Who knows what happened in Canada this week? Emily Letella.
What's all this fuss I hear about David Letterman perspiring? If a late-night host wants to perspire, that's his business. You should see the sweat stains on Arsenio. Chelsea Handler's left armpit is so moist it practically is one of the Great Lakes. Craig Ferguson is so full of sweat they filmed the movie Noah in his jock. And furthermore...
Miss Letella.
Yes?
The story is about David Letterman retiring. not perspiring.
Oh, that's different. Never mind.
And David Letterman has nothing to do with Canada.
Bitch.
Kiefer Sutherland's grandfather.
As the former Premier of Saskatchewan, I know two things. State-sponsored socialism and Paul Schaefer, David Letterman's bald bandleader, is from Thunder Bay.
Wait a minute. I'm about to lose my patented Canadian politeness, eh? Thunder Bay is in Quebec. That means Paul Schaefer is not really from Canada.
Yeah, he's not Canadian. No, he's not.
Ahem. Thunder Bay is in Ontario, not Quebec.
Is this true?
Technically, it's in Ontario, but it might as well be in Quebec.
Okay, I'm on board with that.
Yeah, that's right.
When David Letterman leaves, Paul Schaefer will also leave. How will that affect Canada? Stoner icon Tommy Chong.
I forgot the question, man.
How will Letterman's retirement affect Canada, eh?
Letterman's retirement is, it's fucked, man.
Anyone else? Neil Young.
There is a town in North Ontario. Paul Schaefer comes from there. In my mind, he needs a place to go. When Letterman's replaced by Colbert, leaving us Daveless.
That's our show. Remember to visit Canada, where only one of our mayors is an embarrassing crackhead. Good night. Hey.
The following portion of the Final Edition Radio Hour is made possible by a grant from Smirk Pharmaceuticals.
I take Dirigor epinephamphetamortizone, or Dream. It doesn't do that much for me. It can't take the dog for a walk. It won't fry my breakfast. It can't change the horror of an infinitely blank and hostile universe bent on burying me alive beneath the immeasurable weight of its dark matter. But it does make me feel a little better. For a while. Smirk developed Dream to counteract the horrific side effects brought on by long-term use of its own hypertrophic drugs. And Dream does the job. I do feel a little better. For a while. Then I have to take some more. Ask your doctor if Dream is right for your bottomless sense of despair. In the meantime, here's a few things you should know.
Dirigor epinephrine amphetamortizone can and usually will cause dizziness, violent seizures, loss of hearing, uncontrollable vomiting leading to organ failure, hair loss, loss of fingers, toes, and limbs, leprosy, partial blindness, total blindness, massive strokes, bloody stool, seven groups of terminal cancers, morbid obesity, asphyxia, sudden death, not so sudden death, slow lingering death, death by water, bubonic plague, necrotizing fasciitis or flesh-eating disease, spontaneous combustion, and stage 3 syphilis. Be aware that Dirigor epinephrine amphetamortizone is a powerful toxin with no known antidote. It should not be taken by pregnant women, non-pregnant women, tall women, overweight women, men of any size, children, adolescents, seniors, pets, any human or non-human living thing, except starving, desperately poor Africans in the course of a large-scale clinical trial.
Look, Dream works. I've tried everything for that overwhelming sense of my own inescapable futility, and nothing works like Dream. You know, Dream makes me feel a little better. And who doesn't want to feel a little better? For a while.
This has been a message from your good friends at Smirk.
The Adventures of Rita Rogers, Crime-Solving Succubus. By day, lovely Rita Rogers is Gal Friday for the mayor of Harbor City. By night, she's a succubus, a female demon that has sex with men against their will, reducing them to whimpering piles of jelly. But this little devil uses her powers to fight crime. Tonight's episode, Spy Jinx. We find Rita hard at work in the mayor's office.
Rita, where's the morning paper? What are they saying about that explosion down at the docks?
Right here, Mayor Hedges. The paper says it could be sabotage. Do you think the Germans might be in Harbor City?
Could be the Japs, too. This is the third explosion at the harbor this month. I think there's an Axis spy in town. Oh, look, the article was written by your boy, Meekum.
Jimmy? He's the best cub reporter they have down at the Daily Movement. And the cutest.
Speak of the devil.
What? Who spoke of the devil?
Howdy, Mr. Mayor.
I just meant there's Meekum right now. God, you sure are jumpy, Rita.
Oh, well, who wouldn't be, you know, with a spy in town? Hi there, Jimmy.
Hiya, Rita. We still on for the malt shop after work?
We sure are.
Knock it off, Meekum. Rita has work to do.
Well, Rita might be your gal Friday, Mr. Mayor, but she's my gal every day, right, sweetie?
I sure am, Jimmy, but I gotta get to work. Mayor Hedges, you have a meeting right now with leading citizen Jonathan Trout.
Trout, he's all hot on the collar to do something about the explosions down at the dock. Boy, he sure has become a leading citizen since he suddenly appeared in Harbor City last year. Hey, speak of the... here he is now.
Mr. Mayor, on behalf of the good burghers, citizens of Harbor City, you have to stop the sabotage. I must insist, without a trace of an accent.
I know. I just don't know what to do.
You must round up all the Chinese people in Harbor City.
Don't you mean Japanese? The Chinese are on our side.
We can't be too careful. What's the difference?
Golly, if you're going to round up the Chinese, first give me time to get my laundry back from Mr. Yi.
But we're fighting the Japanese. The Chinese, they aren't...
Stay out of this, Rita. Don't you have some filing to do?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. Oh, achoo!
Gesundheit. God bless you.
Danke schön.
Careful. We have to purge Germanic phrases from our language.
You betcha. I won't even say 9. Not even the number. I go straight from 8 to 10.
Shut up, Meekum. Mr. Trout, I'll round up the Chinese pronto. As soon as I have one last order of chop suey from the Golden Dragon. Rita, you know what to do.
I sure do. There's something fishy about Trout.
What's that, Rita?
Oh, nothing, Mr. Mayor.
Later that night, in the bedroom of Mr. Trout.
Good night, Trout.
Huh? Was ist das? What's going on? You're that meddling girl from down the mayor's office. How did you get into my bedroom?
Don't you mean, how did I get into your dreams, Fritz?
You're naked. I can see your titten. Gasp! Und your bat wings.
Take a good gander at my tail and hoofs, Heinz. Oh, and this too.
Ach, der Fotze, mein Gott.
Hang on, Schickelgruber. I'm about to crush some Nazi Nutsies. Succubus summons.
Vagina di inferno mordito.
Ist kaputt.
That's right, Gunther. And while I was slicing the bratwurst, you signed this confession and gave me this list of every Nazi spy on the whole coast. Toodles, Heinrich. You just got run over by the succubus.
Ach, du Liebe.
Next morning at the mayor's office.
Hi there, Rita. I came by to ask the mayor when the Chinese roundup starts. I got my laundry.
Never mind that, Jimmy. Look at this. It fell out of Mr. Trout's coat yesterday. Do you think it's important?
Wow, I'll say. It looks like a confession. And a list of types of sausages.
I think those are names of German spies, Jimmy. You just busted a spy ring.
Well, Yankee Doodle. Say, Rita, let's celebrate tonight. My folks are out of town. Why don't you come over to the house and...
Now, Jimmy.
Oh, Rita, we've been going out for 2 years. I'm going crazy. I won't tell anyone. Are you worried it'll ruin your reputation?
Oh, Jimmy, that's not what it'll ruin.
The Final Edition Radio Hour East was performed by Jeff Chrysler, Jen Dodd, Rob Gordon, John Marshall, Darby Worley, Bruce Cherry, Kevin Janis, and Tony Hendra. The Final Edition Radio Hour West by Jeff Hendrick, Ebby Parker, Barry Link, Jim Earle, and Steve Rosenfield, with music by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com. It was written by Barry Link, Jeff Chrysler, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, John Marshall, Steve Rosenfield, and Tony Hendra. The Final Edition Radio Hour was edited by Andrew Hammond and Greg Russ and produced by Tony Hendra and Jeff Chrysler. West Coast production by Barry Lank. This has been a production of The Final Edition, LLC, copyright 2014.